Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And we don't just mean the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go paper-tarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out, the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Brought to you by the 2012 Toyota Camry.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I'm an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as always, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Hey there! So today we thought we'd talk a bit about a type of performance that is relatively new as far as performance goes. Something that I guess this falls into our movie-making category, but it's also something that's been used in things like video games and other forms of media as well, motion capture.
Yeah, you'll even see it in sports. Mm-hmm. They've been talking about this for a while now, and if you've ever seen the making of a video or a game, or you know, even in sports rehabilitation in medicine, where the people are wearing dots, little white dots all over their clothing and sometimes their faces and hands, that's probably what they were doing. Either that, or they just really like stickers.
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't? I remember being very competitive in elementary school in order to get a sticker. And also, this is a tangent, but a true story. I got a gold star sticker just last month.
Awesome.
From Tracy, the head of our site. So anyway, motion capture. Actually, there are a lot of different terms that you can use in this realm. Motion capture or mocap is probably the one I hear the most frequently, but also things like performance animation, performance capture, digital puppetry, real-time animation, motion scanning, which is really more of a proprietary thing. But the concept is pretty much the same across the board. The idea is to capture the physical representation of something and then convert it into a virtual format. So usually it's something that's in motion, but it's not always that way. Since, you know, we're talking about motion capture, that makes sense. But you're trying to get translate something that is moving through real space into a digital format. And there's different ways to do this. I mean, you could do it the really hard way, which is where you study something and then you try to recreate it either by hand or by or digitally, you know, by programming movements into an animated figure. But this is an idea that kind of takes that step out, where you are directly porting the movements something is making within physical space into virtual space.
Yeah, there was an early technique, and then of course this is all an attempt to get as real as you can with animation, and one of the earlier techniques that was sort of a predecessor to this is called rotoscoping.
Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings had a lot of rotoscoping in it.
Well, what happens is in that case is a real human being goes through the motions and they act through the parts that you're going to see in the animation.
And they shoot that on film.
Yes, yes. And then the animators basically are looking at that and are drawing more or less on top of that. They see a projection of that and they are drawing the animation over that to capture the way that person's body looks. And this was famous. You know, the Disney studios were famous for this. We're studying models, and then they would do the rotoscoping technique to try to make their characters look more realistic.
Yeah, and there are some artists, like I said, like Bakshi, who famously would leave the film image as part of the animation, so that you had this weird effect where the thing you were looking at was part, quote unquote, real image and part animated image. Which was an artistic choice. Definitely something that was not meant to necessarily fool you into thinking, oh, well, that animated character is moving very realistically. It was done on purpose. But it was, that's what I always think of when I think rotoscoping, is I just think of the different Bakshi films, but in particular, I think of his Lord of the Rings, adaptation. Which, as I recall, ended halfway through The Two Towers. So anyway, that's just bringing back memories. But yeah, that was sort of a precursor to motion capture. Motion capture itself, there are many different ways of achieving this. For example, there were, it's not used very frequently now, but there were mechanical systems where you had sensors that would be attached to specific joints that would relay movement. And usually it was kind of like an actor would wear a physical metallic skeleton type device that would have these sensors attached to the various joints. And as the actor moved, the sensors would register the changes in motion in this metallic skeleton. And that would be relayed through usually cables to a computer system that would measure these or take the measurements from the sensors and translate it into movements for the virtual character. It's very limiting, this particular system. There was another one that was a little more versatile, which used electromagnets. And in this case, you talked about sensors that would be attached by really thick cables that, again, would go to a computer. And there'd be a magnetic field. And by moving through this magnetic field, the sensors would pick up alterations. You know, moving through a magnetic field, you would get little electrical changes. We've talked a lot about electricity and magnetism in general. Moving through fluctuating a magnetic field can induce electricity through a conductor, or putting electricity through a conductor can induce a magnetic field. So anyway, by moving these sensors through the magnetic field, it would create these electronic fluctuations that would then be measured and translated into movement. And again, this was a fairly effective way of picking up movements. It actually didn't use as many points of contact as the optical systems that we mostly think about. That was the kind that Chris was referring to early with all the dots on the person. Those systems tend to have lots and lots and lots of points of reference. The electromagnet ones didn't tend to have as many points of reference because the software side of it, because, you know, we do have a hardware and a software side to this. The software side would assume that the joints that these sensors were attached to behaved the way they normally would in humans, in that they don't have complete freedom of movement. Most of us are not multi-jointed in every joint. So we can't, you know, there, we have a limitation on how far we can move in certain directions with these various joints. So taking that into account, you didn't have to have sensors all over the body. You would just have them in a few places, which was good considering that there were these thick cables attached to the sensors. And then once you were done moving, then the all that data would be captured within the system and could then be rendered into animation. Although this was also a way that you could do real-time animation or digital puppetry. It's not that different from controlling a video game character with a controller. It's sort of the same principle, except in this case, the video game controller, instead of it being something you hold in your hands, it's something you were actually wearing. And I've seen plenty of instances of this. If you've ever seen Turtle Talk with Crush over at Disney, that's what they use. They use a digital, you know, they use digital puppetry. And yeah, it's awesome, by the way. I love that.
Well, it would also seem that you would need to be aware of where those cables were going.
Yes.
And it would also affect the way that you would move. You wouldn't move as naturally.
Yeah.
If you were wearing something like that, as if you were, you know, unencumbered by that.
Which, yeah,
sort of, I think, would lend itself to an upgrade, which is, I think, why they were so keen on the new
optical
system.
Well, it's also that's very true. It did limit what you could do. It would limit your movement. I mean, when you've got these big cables attached to you, obviously you can't just move freely within a space. So it did put some limitations on you. There are limitations to the optical systems too, but we'll get into that. The other problem was that the sampling rate for the magnetic systems was not as high as it is for optical systems. And by sampling rate, what I mean is that the entire system as a whole is taking little measurements of from the sensors, of, you know, the orientation of the sensors within the space. And it does that several times every second. But the sample rate of the magnetic motion capture systems was much lower than what it was than what it would be if you were to use an optical system. So you're not getting data as frequently. I mean, it's still several times a second, but it's not as precise as the optical system. So not only were you limited in the kind of movements you could make because you had these major cables attached to you, but also you couldn't get really minute, precise measurements on every kind of movement. So it wasn't good for things like sports. So, you know, something like throwing a pitch in baseball, there are a lot of movements, little tiny motions that are involved in that. I mean, anyone who's watched slow motion footage of a professional baseball pitcher throwing a pitch, you can see that there are some incredibly subtle movements that are involved in that. And it takes place over a very short period of time. I mean, it's a very fast thing to measure. Using the magnetic motion capture system, you would probably, one, slow the person down because they have all these cables attached to them, and two, not get enough data to give an accurate representation of what had happened in the virtual format. So if you were to, say, create a video game, a baseball video game, the pitcher would not necessarily behave properly if all you did was directly port the data you got from the motion capture into the game.
Yeah, another drawback of the mechanical systems like that too is that it's the kind of system that not only is cumbersome and inaccurate, but it has to be calibrated fairly frequently. And you know, there's some work that you can do with this, but the optical systems that they began to introduce you know, generally became an upgrade. There is one big advantage that the mechanical systems do have, though, and that is that the lighting will not necessarily interfere with the different points of motion that are captured by the mechanical system.
Yeah.
And that can be an issue with the optical systems, you know, because that's why they will be wearing the people, the actors who will be having their motions captured by the system will be wearing, you know, those bright dots so that the computer can pick up on that. And at the beginning, in these early systems, there were only so many points, action points that they could capture. They were very limited in what they could do at first, but still, you know, somewhat of an upgrade over the mechanical.
Yeah, it also limited what you could have in the background, obviously, because you could not have anything that was going to be of a similar shade, you know, usually where you talk about a reflective white substance used as the points of articulation. So the little light, white stickers is like what you were saying, Chris. You couldn't have anything like that in the background because it would confuse the optical system. So that's why a lot of these motion capture scenes are shot against a blue screen or green screen. It's so that the background does not in any way interfere with the motion capture. So if you've ever seen behind the scenes footage of the Lord of the Rings movies is a great example, with Andy Serkis as Gollum, or Smeagol if you prefer. But he's wearing, you know, a tight, like skin tight suit with these little white circles all over it. Those are the points that the cameras track to create the performance of Gollum / Smeagol. So the performance is something that's being created not only by the actor, but also the animators. Because we should also point out that the motion capture stuff rarely is motion capture, completely, there's rarely a moment where you don't have an animator step in and tweak it somehow. Like, you don't normally have someone create a physical performance, and that physical performance is completely without any tinkering represented in the final product. I mean, it can happen. There are instances of it, but it's more frequently something where the motion capture performance goes to the animator, who can then tweak things if the performance is not exactly what it needs to be, which is kind of nice. You don't necessarily have that luxury with flesh and blood actors.
That's true. Well, especially with the earlier systems, especially the electromagnetic systems, those were really noisy, not literally noisy, but digital noise. They weren't really highly accurate. The optical systems are far cleaner and give a more accurate representation. But, you know, it sort of falls in the realm of artistic license, I would think, where they need to go in and make subtle adjustments to make it look the way they want it to look.
Yeah. I should also point out, you just reminded me of something else, another drawback to the electromagnet systems, which was you couldn't have anything metal on the set because it would interfere with that magnetic field and give incorrect readings to the system. So your virtual character would not move in the same way as the physical one because there would be some interference in that sense. So your set couldn't have anything metal in it. The props shouldn't have anything metal in them. So that limited you as well. So each system has its own limitations. Getting back to the optical one, one of the other things you have to remember is that in order to really capture a physical object moving through 3D space and to replicate that in virtual space, you need multiple cameras in that system, because a single camera, assuming that's a regular video or film camera, something that does not have 3D capability, pointing that at an object, it's creating a two-dimensional image of something that's moving in three dimensions. The camera can't necessarily tell where movements are happening within the depth frame of that image, right? So if someone's moving in such a way where, let's say they're moving their head where it'd be bobbing closer to the camera, unless the size of the sensors is such that something that subtle could be picked up by the camera system, you would lose that information. So what you need are multiple cameras on the same object so that you can compare that data from the multiple angles to tell how this object is really moving through this three-dimensional space. So it's kind of like the idea of having parallax with two eyes. You know, our eyes are offset, so by looking at an object, we can tell how far away it is in part because of parallax. We also have other visual cues that tell us about how far something is, you know, things like how tall it is in relation to where we are, that kind of thing, or how tall it is in relation to other objects that are within our frame of vision. But parallax is very important. Same sort of thing with these optical systems. You would have multiple cameras set up to try and capture the information that's going on in the frame so that you could tell exactly how it's moving through that three-dimensional space.
Yeah, it seems like in order to capture the correct perspective, you need that additional information. Even though you may not necessarily see it, it helps the animator do that. And the optical system, too, allows you to work with more than one actor.
Yep.
Which was not really an option with some of the earlier systems. So, in other words, you can, although it requires more equipment, you know, just simply out of necessity, the optical system is really affording the animators an opportunity to use a greater amount of information, both, you know, from the different points of data they're getting from a single actor, but from multiple actors on the set simultaneously, which enables them to create more complex work.
Right. And this also gives us a good example of how the optical motion capture systems are a passive system, because you have these sensors you're wearing that are not necessarily – well, not even sensors. They're reflective markers that you're wearing. They aren't connected to any sort of electronic components at all, versus the active systems like the electromagnetic one, where you are generating data by moving through a magnetic field and you have these big cables attached to it. With the optical motion capture systems, another thing that's kind of interesting, I think, is that a lot of, at least the early ones, the cameras would have infrared LEDs, so emitters, really, that were emitting infrared light. So that's outside our visible spectrum. We cannot see infrared light. But by putting an infrared filter on the camera, you could have the camera pick up reflections of infrared light, and that was a way of helping to identify the sensors that you had put on the actor. The actors, the sensors would be reflective specifically so that the infrared light would reflect back toward the camera and give the most accurate rendering of what's going on at any given moment within a scene. So, yeah, it's another way of making sure that the data being captured is as precise as possible. I mean, that is, of course, the goal, is to try and recreate the physical movements as truthfully as you possibly can, given all the limitations involved.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, and if you're looking for a real-life, easy-to-find an example of this, you would look no farther than your local video game store, because the Xbox Kinect uses very much that exact form of technology. It is using an infrared emitter, and it has cameras that it uses to pick it up, pick the information up that is coming back from what is being reflected around the room. And anybody who has one is also aware that lighting is very much an issue. The way the room is lit affects the information that the Kinect is able to refer to the Xbox. Now, it's not, while it is sophisticated, it is not as sophisticated as the kind of equipment that they might use in making a movie or making a video game, but it is, very, very similar technology. And in some ways, I would argue that it's more sophisticated than some of those early, systems simply because it is able to capture a lot of information. Whereas, you know, the very early optical systems were only using a handful of data points.
Right.
So it's a pretty neat device, you know, not only used for gaming now. The hacker community has fallen in love with it, too, because it can do so much and can be used for so many things and is, you know, fairly inexpensive.
Yeah. The cool thing about the Kinect is that rather than have to – obviously, if you've ever played an Xbox with a Kinect, you know you don't have to go out and buy – a snug bodysuit covered in reflective markers in order to play. I mean, it doesn't hurt, but you know, if you can pull that look off, there are very few of us who can. I count myself among them. But you don't have to do that because what it's doing is it's actually projecting essentially a grid in infrared light. So you can't see the grid, but it's being projected into the room, and then when you move within the space, you are deforming that grid. You know, the camera that's picking up the reflections of that infrared light can detect when the grid's being deformed by a physical object interrupting the grid. So as you move, you interrupt different parts of the grid, and it can start to interpret those as motions and commands. It's not as precise as what we're talking about with the optical systems that are used in movies and video games, to create them, that is, not to play them. It's not as precise as those, but it also has other elements that help balance that out. Like it has regular optical cameras that can have some other software that aids it in recognizing things, like facial recognition software, which does not necessarily rely upon that infrared grid. It relies more on the traditional camera functions, but has the software included that lets the programs within recognize who is standing in front of it. So that combination increases the precision, which of course is very important whenever you're playing a game. I mean, anyone who's played any sort of game where you're using a faulty controller, or it's just a system that hasn't been fully it's not finished yet. It's just in prototype stage or whatever. You may have noticed that that it could be very frustrating to try and control something where the actual controller is not as responsive as you would hope. It's not a fun experience. But anyway, that is kind of related to this whole motion capture technology. I'm sorry. You look like you have something to say.
Well, no. I was going to say that you know, we really hadn't, other than my earlier statement about sports, you know, we've been talking about it in entertainment, about the ability to capture motion to make characters more realistic. And, that is exactly what they want to do when they are using this in sports medicine. Jonathan alluded to earlier the difficulty in capturing all the little subtle motions that go into a Major League Baseball player's pitching. And you know, when somebody gets hurt, sometimes they go through extensive surgery. The Tommy John procedure is famous. You know, they do a ligament transplant to help rebuild a pitcher's elbow, and that can really throw off the mechanics of a pitcher's motion. So they use this motion capture technology to really get an idea of how that person is throwing, going about the mechanics of their typical gameplay. And that's exactly the same kind of thing that they're doing when they create these very, realistic sports games. You know, in this case, they're using it for sports medicine to see if they can go back and recreate some of the motions that made them so successful before they were injured. Now, ironically, in entertainment purposes, especially video, you can get too realistic. The Japanese professor Masahiro Mori is famous for his uncanny valley, mm-hmm. Which has been used in used as a robotics term for a robot that looks so much and moves so much like a human that it creeps us out. It looks a little too realistic. And I can think of – we're actually recording this in December of 2012, and one of the movies that comes on about this time of year is The Polar Express, which is
– it's a nightmare.
Known as – loved and reviled both for its story and its – and the way that they use motion capture, because the characters in there are so realistic. They're downright creepy.
Yeah. It's one of those things where they are almost but not quite able to pass for a real person, so that there's just enough off about them to be unsettling. Now, this does bring up something else that's kind of interesting. We have an article on HowStuffWorks.com about motion scan technology, which is, as I said earlier, a proprietary technology. It's more specific than just motion capture. It's specifically meant to capture facial motion activity. So when an actor is speaking, when they're delivering lines, the way that they furrow their brow or move their eyes or smile or they give a facial tic, anything like that, this system is designed to pick that up so that it can be recreated virtually in a game. And it was used to great effect, in my opinion, in L.A. Noire. Now, L.A. Noire was a video game that came out in 2011, and it was a game in which you played you played a couple different characters, but the one you played for most of the game, spoiler alert, was a police detective. And you're kind of rising through the ranks in L.A. During the early part of the 20th century. And it's notable in that you are, you're spending most of the game looking at people's reactions. You know, the idea behind L.A. Noire was a new type of video game where you would interrogate characters, throughout your investigations. And as you interrogate them, you had to watch the character's facial reactions to kind of get an idea of whether the character was trying to be evasive or if they were telling the truth. And you would do things like watch for their eyes. And if they weren't able to maintain eye contact, that was an indication that perhaps they were being less than truthful. Or if they would, you know, twitch their mouth or clench their jaw, these would be little hints that perhaps there's more going on than what they're letting on to. And obviously, if your gameplay depends upon trying to determine whether or not a virtual character is telling the truth, you have to be able to represent those facial expressions as closely to reality as possible, or else the game does not work. So they use this motion scan technology, and the way that they did this was that they had a very brightly lit studio that had lights trained on an actor from just about every angle. And the purpose of that was to try and eliminate shadows, because any sort of shadows you would have there would, of course, affect the actual capture. It was really all about the light. And they used 32 high-definition cameras. So think about that. 32 high-definition cameras just to capture an actor's facial performance. Like, that's it. There's no other movement. The actor is seated at the time and had to remain as still as possible and just do all the acting with their face, which for anyone out there who's done any sort of acting, you know that's incredibly challenging because actors are trained to use their whole body when they are making a performance. They're trained to really think about movement. I mean, if you're really serious about acting, you've probably taken movement classes, and to suddenly have all of that taken away and all of your acting is restricted to just your face, that's pretty dramatic. It's tough to do. But anyway, that's what the actors had to do. They had to sit down and restrict their acting to just their facial expressions without it going like over the top crazy, because that would be just as distracting as not enough performance at all. And these 32 cameras were paired up, so 16 pairs of cameras. There was a 33rd camera as well that the director used to watch the scene and give directions to the actors. But these pairs of cameras were trained on all these different angles of the face in order to capture that performance so that in the virtual world they could recreate it accurately, which to me is phenomenal. And apparently the way the system works is you get that virtual version of the person's face and head almost instantly, which is kind of creepy, but also awesome.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's funny too that they use that many cameras in the creation of a video game, because as elsewhere in that article, it notes that Serkis, who was playing Gollum or Smeagol, only had 25 cameras on him. But in doing so, they were able to create roughly, 10,000 different kind, or identify 10,000 different kinds of facial movements that they could use in animating the character on screen. So, clearly, this is very, very high tech and, painstaking procedure to do, but in doing so, they can create very, very realistic movements.
Yeah. There's a lot of number crunching involved. And frankly, the part that takes place after you've captured the data can be dramatically different from one case to the next. In some cases, you may have already created an animated figure pretty much from start to finish. You might not have completely put textures on it or something, but you might have essentially the way the character is going to look in the finished product, and then you just map it to the movements that you captured, and there it goes. And in other cases, you might see that what they do is they capture the motions, and then you essentially have what looks like a very primitive stick figure skeleton that moves in the way that the actor moved, but there's no definition. There's no character there yet. And you may have animators who build the character somewhat based upon the way the actor moved through the space, so that perhaps the character's design is not finalized until you've captured that performance, and the performance helps guide the design of the character. It all depends on the specific technology that's being used and the preference of the crew that's designing whatever it is that they're making, whether it's a video game or a movie, TV show, commercial, whatever it happens to be. In the case of digital puppetry, obviously you would already have the full character realized, so that just by using whatever control mechanism happens to be there, you would be able to make the puppet move in real time. Otherwise, it's not really puppetry. And again, that's sort of like if you've been to that Turtle Talk thing I talked about, the at Disney World or Disneyland. I'm sure there are other similar ones. I think Monsters, Inc., Laugh Factory has a similar setup where you've got a digital character on a screen that can react in real time to things that are happening within the physical environment. So they interact with the audience. Like, they'll specifically single people out and chat with people in the audience. And to kids, this is amazing. I mean, it's a cartoon character acting in real time. It's a real person now. To adults, it's fascinating because they're like, how the heck did that happen? But yeah, it's all based on this same sort of technology. And it's really interesting to me to see how the field is evolving over time, because things like the Kinect show that we are adapting this same sort of technology in different ways. We're using different implementations to essentially do the same thing, and that perhaps we will get to a point where we won't have to worry about all the sensors so much. You can maybe have an actor who's not completely coated in stickers perform, and you could capture all that data without having to worry about, tracking these little dots. That might be something that we see in the future. I mean, the motion scan is kind of like that, because before motion scan, with that facial acting, technology, whenever I saw anyone who was having their face tracked for a performance, they always were wearing those tiny little white stickers all over their face to track. I mean, we got a lot of muscles in our face. There's something like 19 muscles or something that you have to track. So you would have all these little dots on your face to track those motions. Well, with motion scan, you don't need those anymore. So maybe we'll see something like that. Of course, that would really depend upon perhaps the lighting, which could – if you're shooting a virtual character that's next to real characters, like in The Lord of the Rings, real being, I guess, your mileage may vary. I mean, they're hobbits. But anyway, when you're next to real people, clearly you can't mess with the lighting too much, or it'll just make the whole scene look strange.
Speaking of strange, while you might think that the techniques used in motion capture, you know, bringing film into it, you know, adding a lot of advancement to film. Basically, some people sort of regard this as cheating.
Yeah.
I did some research that indicated that although some other types of animation are considered more artful, motion capture is sort of not everyone, but some people say, well, you know, it's not Oscar worthy because you were using these computer aided animation techniques that really are simulating human motion, and it's just not real. And the argument that I've seen used against it is, well, you consider rotoscoping okay, why don't you consider motion capture, which is a kind of descendant from this technology? Why isn't that okay to consider for quality and for awards? But apparently it's sort of a hot topic among movie makers.
Yeah, I can see why an animator, a traditional animator, or even a computer animator, I mean, that's closer and closer to becoming traditional already, but either hand-drawn animation or computer animation, someone who goes through the trouble of animating these things and doing a lot of this work by hand seems like it's the wrong term, but personally going through and creating these performances, I can see where they might feel that way. I have a completely different perspective on it. Of course, I'm not an animator, so that's part of it. But I think of it as creating a performance. And in the sense of creating a performance, I think it's a completely legitimate tool because you're still relying on an actor to create a performance that people will relate to, whether it's a character that you're supposed to love or hate or fear. That all is dependent upon the animator and the actor and several other people working to create this performance. And I don't see anything wrong with that. That to me is a completely legitimate form of creating the art of entertainment. So, I mean, I do understand from an artistic perspective where some people could have a problem with it, but if you take a bigger picture look at not just, you know, what technique you're using, but the end goal of creating, whether you want to call it art or not, but creating something that has an impact to the viewer or player in the case of a video game, I think that's more important. But then again, I'm not an animator, so I don't have that kind of emotional attachment. You know, I'm not invested in it in that way. So I'd be curious to hear what our listeners think. If they think that is motion capture, is that cheating? Is it as Red versus Blue would have you say, a legitimate strategy? What do you think? What do you consider motion capture? You should let us know.
Yeah, I do see where it might make a traditional animator concerned, but I don't really think it diminishes their artistic value to a work, whatever it may be that they are working on. And there are certain times, I'm sure, where you would argue that using these techniques is completely inappropriate to what they might do.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, it's always a concern when you start saying, well, the machine can do it, and we don't really need people to do it, so get out.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever going to be fully the case, because you're going to have certain characters within movies that are going to be so different from the way humans are built, so to speak, that motion capture would not be practical. For example, like let's say that the character that you're creating has really super long arms. And, you know, you got an actor who's pretty lanky, but their arms are not as long as the character's arms. If you were just to do a direct translation of the actor's movements into the animation, it might not look right because the character has different dimensions. Their body is built differently than the actor. And so without tweaking it, without having an animator go in there and adjust this and make it look correct, compared to what the vision is for the movie, it doesn't come out correctly. It doesn't look right. So I think there's very little risk of motion capture ever taking that away completely. Plus, there is something to, you know, creating a performance through traditional animation that, you know, it does feel differently than motion capture, but that's not a bad thing. Like, it just depends upon the vision of the director and what the tone of the piece needs to be. And in some cases, motion capture is going to be the best way to achieve that. In other cases, motion capture would make it distracting. So, yeah, I think as long as we maintain this desire for different types of entertainment and techniques, then there's not really any risk of making one disappear.
Yeah, I agree completely. I really do. It's just a different animal.
Yep. But hey, guys, if you want to chime in on this motion capture discussion, please do. Let us know. Send us an email. Our address is techstuff@discovery.com, or get in touch with us on Twitter or Facebook. Our handle at both of those is techstuffhsw. And Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Brought to you by the 2012 Toyota Camry.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway the great American race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.